he's caught it between a rock and a hard place. If he speaks out for the Rohingya, the Christians in Myanmar may suffer more persecution than they're already suffering now.
Some in the church are apprehensive about the papal trip to Myanmar. This is Tuesday, November 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, demonstrations over blasphemy come to a controversial end in many cities in Pakistan. And three Chinese nationals are accused of hacking the computers in three international but U.S.-based corporations. All on today's VOA Asia. Myanmar's military chief said he told Pope Francis that there is no religious discrimination in his country, where violence against Rohingya Muslims has been termed ethnic cleansing by the United States. Myanmar has no religious discrimination at all, according to Senior General Ming Aung Hlaing. He said that in a Facebook post by his office. Likewise, our military, too, he says, it performs for the peace and stability of the country. Pope Francis met with Myanmar's military chief Monday as he began his trip to the Southeast Asian country to discuss violence in the Rakhine State, which has caused over 620,000 Rohingya Muslims to flee into neighboring Bangladesh. After the 15-minute meeting, Vatican spokesman Greg Burke had said the two discussed the great responsibility of authorities of the country in this time of transition before they exchanged gifts. The pontiff was greeted by Myanmar clerics as he arrived at the Yangon airport. Catholics make up one of the smallest religious minorities in Myanmar. Nonetheless, crowds lined the streets of Yangon, waving yellow Vatican flags as the Pope's motorcade made its way through the streets. Not all are behind the papal journey to Myanmar. We welcome to VOA Asia Father Thomas Rees. He's a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and he is senior analyst at the Religion News Service. And we want to stress here that Father Rees is speaking for himself and not for the commission. Father Rees, why do you think the visit of the Pope might not be the best decision here?
He's in a very difficult situation. As you know, the Rohingya Muslims have been treated just abysmally in their country. The United Nations has referred to it as a case study in ethnic cleansing. And so these are the kinds of people that the Pope's heart goes out to. In fact, he has spoken in defense of the Rohingya Muslims from Rome. But now that he's going to Myanmar, where this is happening, the Catholic Church leaders there are telling him, don't even use the word Rohingya, because it's a controversial word with many of the Buddhists in Myanmar. So he's caught it between a rock and a hard place. If he speaks out for the Rohingya, the Christians in Myanmar may suffer more persecution than they're already suffering now. On the other hand, if he goes to Myanmar and says nothing about the Rohingya, people are going to be asking, well, why not? Why hasn't he spoken out in defense of these people? So he's been put in a very difficult position.
So what do you think he should have done instead? As you have stressed in the beginning of your statement, was that he feels very, very deeply about this kind of situation and has become involved in the past.
Well, I think he's been speaking out very appropriately from Rome, speaking on behalf of the Rohingya, calling for reconciliation between Muslims, Christians, and Buddhists. That's very important for him to do that. On the other hand, you know, going to Myanmar, I hope he can be a force for reconciliation there. But on the other hand, you know, the Pope's not a miracle worker. Nobody else has been able to solve this problem. But, you know, hopefully he can, point a light at the problem, but I hope he can do it in a way that doesn't cause more grief and persecution for the Christians in Myanmar.
Low be it for us to tell the Pope what to do, and I know neither you or me wants to do that, but what do you think would be the best option on how to handle this except for not going?
Well, that's going to be really tough. I think he's going to have to be very careful in the words he uses. He is going to meet with the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, and that's very, very important that he be seen and reaching out to them so that the whole world community can see how what dire straits they are in the they hardly have even refugee camps. It's just an awful situation they're living in, and they need the international community to come to their assistance. I think he's got to speak while he's in Myanmar to the government and to the military. Now, whether that's behind closed doors or publicly is a tough call. I think he will speak very clearly to the government of Myanmar and also to the military, who are the real power in Myanmar, this kind of ethnic cleansing and persecution has to stop. But whether he does that publicly or behind closed doors is a judgment call that I would leave to him.
We thank Father Thomas Rees, a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and the senior analyst at Religion News Service. Father Rees, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Pope Francis meets with Myanmar's military chief. A top-level volcano alert in Bali sparks evacuation and airport closures. Pakistan is criticized for surrendering to a protesting Islamist group. South Korea warns the North not to repeat an armistice violation, the shooting of an escaping soldier. And a new study shows rising Chinese ozone levels causing higher mortality. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. A controversial deal the government in Pakistan struck with an Islamist group Monday has forced the federal law minister out of office and eased angry demonstrations that claimed several lives and had for weeks paralyzed the national capital. As a matter of fact, they've been called off now. Thousands of activists earlier this month had blocked the main entrance to Islamabad and refused to disperse unless the government ousted the law minister Zahid Hamid for allegedly committing blasphemy. These allegations against the Pakistani law minister stem from amendments in the wording of the oath taken by incoming lawmakers that protesters maintained amounted to blasphemy for undermining the fundamental Muslim proclamation of Muhammad as the last prophet of Islam. The government dismissed the demand and ordered a police crackdown on Saturday to clear the protest site in the face of growing public pressure against the siege. That action resulted in clashes with demonstrators in which 7 people died and nearly 200 others were wounded. In reaction, the supporters of the protest leaders took to the streets in other major Pakistani cities, blocking roads and motorways, with some carrying out attacks on houses of federal ministers, including that of Hamid. The spillover of violence to the rest of Pakistan forced authorities to suspend the police crackdown and enter into talks with the rally leaders. That agreement called for the immediate removal of Minister Hamid and bound the government to release all detained activists and pay for any damage to public property. Critics have denounced the government for giving in to the demands of the Islamist group, saying it will encourage extremism in the country. The chairman of the Pakistani Senate was outraged at the controversial deal. Raza Rabbani slammed the government for not consulting parliament on an issue of national importance. In another Pakistan-related story, a Saudi-led Muslim military coalition commanded by a former Pakistan army chief was officially launched Sunday in Riyadh, where defense ministers of the participating nations met for the inaugural meeting. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is also defense minister of Saudi Arabia, opened the meeting of the Islamic Military Counterterrorism Coalition, also called IMCTC. An official statement explained the pan-Islamic coalition of 41 predominantly Sunni Muslim countries will coordinate and multiply their individual efforts in the global fight against terrorism and violent extremism. The formation of the coalition is not being met with unanimous approval in Pakistan. Joining us is Ayaz Ghul, who reports from Pakistan for VOA. Ayaz, what's behind this story?
Well, this is, Saudi Arabia has been trying to put together sort of a coalition, a military coalition of its allied nations. And in 2015, the Saudi leadership announced some initial structure of a coalition it wanted to put together. And they named it differently, but over the last year and a half, after some structure was devised, it has been named now as Islamic Military Counterterrorism Coalition. And the objective of this coalition, according to Saudis, is to basically counter terrorism and violent extremism in Muslim countries from a joint front like the one they launched in Riyadh, where defense ministers of 41 countries who are part of this coalition met for the inaugural session, and that's where this coalition formally was launched. And again, under a lot of skepticism and suspicions about its real objectives.
Well, they are predominantly made up of Sunni Muslim countries, correct? So, what is the thought here as to what possibly is really going on?
Well, that very fact that predominantly Sunni Muslim nations are part of this coalition has created this controversy, especially in Iran and in other Muslim countries where Shiite Muslims are also in a sizable majority, because Iranian leaders from the outset have been opposing this idea. They believe that this Saudi Arabia, because as we know, Saudi Arabia and these are major rivals in the Middle East, and Iranian leadership believes that Saudi Arabia is trying to increase its political influence in the region through such efforts by creating such a coalition. But at the same time, there's also fear in Tehran that maybe this coalition will be, at the end of the day, used against Iran one way or the other, because the current Saudi leadership, according to Iranians, is really looking at Tehran as a major enemy. And that is why they have been opposing it. And, you know, the reason, not only Iran, but here in Pakistan, there has been a lot of criticism of Islamabad joining this coalition, because Iran shares like nearly 1,000 kilometer border with Pakistan and has traditionally good cultural and political ties with Pakistan. But at the same time, Pakistan also has a very strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. And that is why the criticism here in Pakistan has been that if Pakistan joins one of the parties, like either Saudi Arabia or sides with Iran, it will basically be involving itself in a foreign conflict like whatever is happening in the Middle East. So people have been critics here have been advising the country not to be part of it, but because of the close relationship with Saudi Arabia, obviously Pakistan agreed a year ago when Saudi Arabia offered to make the chief of this new coalition a former Pakistani army general, General Rahil Sharif. And interestingly, the Pakistan government immediately agreed to it. And General Rahil Sharif, when the coalition was launched in Riyadh, has now formally taken command of this new coalition. But amid fears and concerns here in Pakistan that the Shiite minority community is not happy, and they have demonstrated through statements and through meetings with leadership here that they're not happy because this coalition might be used against Iran, and that is not good for Pakistan, where Shiite and Sunni militant groups have been attacking each other for years.
Ayaz Ghul reporting and talking with us from Islamabad for VOA. And Ayaz, once again, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Happening now in Asia, Pakistani police exhume a couple's bodies suspecting honor killing. Pope Francis held talks Monday with Myanmar's military chief at the start of a delicate visit there. The UN Human Rights Council expected to hold a special session on killings, rapes, and other crimes committed against Muslim Rohingya in Myanmar. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. Authorities on the Indonesian tourist island of Bali have raised the volcano alert to the highest level as Mount Agung continues to churn and belch menacing-looking ash and smoke. Officials have ordered all people within 10 kilometers of the mountain to evacuate. But while that activity on Mount Agung looks frightening, the head of Indonesia's geological agency says he does not expect a major eruption. He said the alert was raised because the volcano began pouring out magma instead of steam and that officials must be alert and anticipate. Flights have been diverted from the Bali airport, and the airport on the neighboring Lombok Island was closed. People looking to leave Bali were stranded because of flight cancellations. Mount Agung began rumbling and sending ash clouds into the sky on Tuesday. Mount Agung last erupted in 1963, killing more than 1,000 people. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia, Pakistani Islamists call off protest after a law minister resigns. Three Chinese nationals are accused of hacking computers in three U.S.-based corporations. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and to share. This is VOA Asia. Three Chinese nationals were accused of hijacking computers in three corporations, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. Wu Yongzhao, Hang Donghao, and Xia Li were indicted Monday by a grand jury for computer hacking, theft of trade secrets, conspiracy and identity theft, and intentionally causing damage to those computer systems. The charges were brought by Acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security Dana Buente, Acting U.S. Attorney Susie Song for the Western District of Pennsylvania, and Special Agent in Charge Robert Johnson of the FBI's Pittsburgh Division. Three corporations, Moody's Analytics, Siemens AG, and Trimble Incorporated, were the victims of the alleged attacks, which took place between 2011 and May 2017. This news alert from VOA Asia, Myanmar's top military leader denies any religious discrimination in a military campaign in Rakhine State. Bali's Mount Agung volcano threatens to blow its top. Protests are winding down in Pakistan's capital. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As tensions escalate between North Korea and the United States, Hawaii finds itself on the front lines in preparing for a nuclear attack. Whether or not North Korea has developed the capability of hitting the islands with a missile, state officials are taking no chances. Heidi Chang has more from Honolulu.
Starting in December, Hawaii will be testing its attack warning siren for the first time since the Cold War in the 1980s. The state is adding the signal to its monthly attention alert test, which warns people of an incoming tsunami or hurricane. While the wailing siren could be used to warn of a nuclear strike from North Korea, Vermiyagi, who's the administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, says he thinks an attack is unlikely.
If North Korea launches against us or allies, the retaliation will be complete, and that would defeat North Korea's ambition to continue its regime. So if they did launch an attack against us, their regime would probably end.
Nevertheless, Miyagi's agency is ramping up efforts to educate the state's 1.4 million residents and also visitors on how to prepare for a nuclear attack.
Hawaii is a likely target because we're in the Pacific. We're closer into North Korea than most of the continental United States, so it's something that we need to prepare for. As we track the news and we see the tests, both missile launches and nuclear tests, you know, it's the elephant in the room. We have to consider it. We can't ignore it.
That's why the state has posted guidelines online to prepare people for a nuclear attack. It's also getting the word out through community meetings and public service announcements.
The attack warning signal advises everyone to take immediate shelter. Get inside, stay tuned. To find out more...
World War II veteran Ted Tsukiyama recalls hearing the air raid warning sirens after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor.
Sirens are installed all over the city after the war started. And then, you know, of course, they would test them every now and then. So I remember hearing the sirens go off every now and then. The radio would give us a warning that say, this is only a test and all that. You know, don't get alarmed and all that.
Tsukiyama, who's now in his late 90s, says he isn't surprised the sirens are coming back because Hawaii has long been a defense outpost. It's home to the U.S. Pacific Command, the military's headquarters for the Asia-Pacific region.
I suppose that's necessary as a precaution, but I don't think North Korea is going to try to attack. They'd be foolish to threaten South Korea or Japan or the U.S.
U.S. officials estimate a North Korean missile could reach Hawaii in about 20 minutes. It would take 5 minutes for authorities to determine its target, which would leave about 12 to 15 minutes to warn the public. Despite the state's public outreach and education efforts, Miyagi says there are still misconceptions.
The first one that I've heard is that we shouldn't prepare, we shouldn't plan, because it's never going to happen, so we're wasting our time. The second misconception is that there's no use preparing, no use planning, because if it's a nuclear attack, we're all going to die. But based on what the threat is right now, if there is an impact, you know, there will be many, many, many survivors, 80%, 90% survivors.
So Miyagi encourages everyone to have a plan and know where to shelter in place ahead of time. Officials also recommend having enough food and water to survive for 48 hours and supplies to last up to 14 days, just in case. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
Eight bodies, which had been reduced partly to skeletons, were found Monday in a small wooden ship that washed up on a beach in the Sea of Japan, according to the Japanese Coast Guard. The ship came ashore on a beach about 70 kilometers north of a marina, where police last week found eight men who said they were from North Korea. Police say they appeared to be fishermen whose boat, found nearby, had run into trouble. The Coast Guard said they were working to establish the nationalities of the eight bodies on the ship. The bodies of two males, similarly partly skeletonized, were also found at the weekend on the western shore of the Sea of Japan island of Sado. Although the nationalities of these two have not yet been established, what appeared to be North Korean cigarettes and life jackets with Korean lettering on them were nearby, according to the Coast Guard station. Both local police and the JCG, the Coast Guard, said the two may have been from North Korea. The incidents come at a time of rising tension over North Korea's nuclear arms and missile programs after President Donald Trump redesignated the isolated nation as a state sponsor of terrorism, allowing the United States to levy further sanctions. Experts say North Korea's food shortage could be behind what is potentially a series of accidents involving North Korean ships. And word from Pakistan, the police there say they have arrested 10 people now for killing a newlywed couple who entered into a free will marriage in the southern port city of Karachi. An officer said Monday that 24-year-old Abdul Hadi, 19-year-old Hasina Bibi were killed by relatives for marrying without permission from their elders earlier this month. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com, and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jimmy Cook, our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Mellon in Washington. Enjoy your day.